I've tried to somehow use my traumas in my work. It's the only way I can get something positive out of the things I experienced, you know, trying to change them into something productive.
That was Michael Bertelsen.
And this is Nordic Portraits. Just checking the levels and recording.
But how is it possible to search into your family history? Is like your grandfather's father, what how many generations back?
I think it's now up to six generations.
Since they came from Scotland and...
Yeah, and England. And there's a record pretty much in all cases you can track back. And then, of course, it's more difficult if you want to go through the previous generations that were abroad.
Do you have, for example, archives with lists of people sailing to Australia?
Yeah, you do. All of it's documented.
The Catford family would be in those archives?
Absolutely.
And that name has gone through six generations?
Yes.
So were they criminals?
I don't believe so. At least that's what they tell me. No, I think they were the classic case of British farmers caught in poverty at that time who were offered a better life in Australia. So you got £10. You got...
From the British state?
Yes.
And that would be the equivalent of...
Let's say maybe $10,000 today, I'm not sure. And then you had a one-way trip on a boat with your family. And then you had a plot of land, as far as I understand. And I don't know how they determined what size that was. But yeah, so my family settled in marginal land in South Australia, which is borderline desert.
It is?
Yeah.
Can anything grow there?
Well, I asked my uncle, how far are we from the desert where you can't farm? And he said, oh, about 10 kilometers, which is funny because his property is probably 10 by 10 kilometers anyway. So they're right on the margin.
He's still a farmer?
Yeah. And technology has only aided that. It's incredible today, the yields they can get from the crop, but they're still very much at the mercy of 2 to 3 good rains every year. If they don't get that, the crop burns out. So it's wheat and sheep.
Okay. So you want to do like media work instead of being a farmer in Australia? I don't understand that.
Yeah.
Because given the opportunity, I would be in Australia being a farmer.
Would you?
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
And get out of media. It's totally, I don't know what you call it, but it's almost not worth anything at the end. You need to get out.
Well, it's interesting because farming is not the trajectory, because both my parents broke with tradition and became priests, both of them.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, ministers of the church. So,
is that why you don't want to be in Australia?
I don't think it had much of a role to play. But certainly I was brought up in a very, small, tight-knit community. And I think you start to feel like you need to spread your wings a little bit.
But ministers, how, like in a Protestant Catholic?
Correct. Yeah, I would say it's fairly akin to the state church here.
Okay, so it's not like a sect?
Not at all. No. It's very contemporary in terms of the ceremonial or liturgical elements, but from a theological standpoint, for all intents and purposes, it's very much akin to the state church, I would say.
Okay, so as a child, did you pray, you know, together with your parents?
And, yeah, we did. Okay. And I think, my concept of faith has very much been, is obviously something that came from what was modeled to me when I was young.
Yeah.
I know you didn't, for example, have the same experience because your father...
My father was brought up in a very religious home, but with a very strict father who worked for the National Danish Railway System. And at that time, that was some of the most prestigious jobs you could have, working for the state railway. So my father was very fond of jazz music growing up in Aalborg, which is northern Jutland. Aalborg is maybe, I don't know, the fourth biggest town in Denmark. And I had a very old father. He was 47 when I was born. And he was born in 1922. So in the 30s, jazz came to Denmark and the Mills Brothers, which were like a barbershop quartet, were coming to Aalborg. So my grandfather gave my father, like, what you call it when you're not allowed to leave home.
Grounded him.
Yeah. Normally you will get it when you've done something wrong, but this was in pre-advance.
Preemptive grounding.
Yeah, just to keep him away from the jazz concerts, because my grandfather thought jazz music was like the devil's music. And I remember my father telling me that there was some kind of wine plant growing, you know, that almost is glued to the house.
Like a creeper vine.
Yeah. So he could crawl down from his room and run away to the jazz concerts. And he was punished very hard when my grandfather found out that he had been there. And so he became a carpenter. And there he learned how to drink. They were drinking, I mean, a lot of beer, especially during the winter time. So he very early was trained in heavy drinking, but came to Copenhagen and became like a building constructor and on a bar called Laurits Betjent, I think. I'm not sure, but there's a Danish song called Sidder på et værtshus. Mm-hmm. Sidder på et værtshus, nær ved Gammelstranden. The text is like, this man is sitting there at this bar and he's extremely drunk. And I noticed a line the other day because it says, hjem til skideballen. Now, I will get home and my wife will be extremely angry. Hjem til skideballen. Hvor herre bevares. Oh, dear Lord. Man har jo kun været væk et døgn. I've only been away for 24 hours, which is, I mean,
absurd.
Compared to today, if you're like late for 10 minutes, your wife will search for you everywhere. Or if you're away for 2 hours, she will call the police. Man har kun været væk et døgn. I've only been away for 24 hours. And so my father is at this bar and he meets a professor from the Architect Academy. And even though he's really bad at mathematics, this professor called Kai Fisker, who actually was the architect of the hospital my father died in, this professor cheats him into the architect school. And then from there on, I think that's why I'm asking you if you are in Denmark because of, you know, running away from where you come from. Because my father, I think, spent all his life trying to get away from his upbringing, and he traveled to America and was there for 5 years as an architect, and traveled to Japan and was there for 7 years. So that's why he met my mother when he came home from that life in America and Japan, and my mother was much younger, 17 years younger than my father, and yeah.
Did you have a good relationship with him?
To my father? I mean, if I look out this window, there's a graveyard, and I can almost see his grave. I would say I was very inspired by him because he was extremely anarchistic and out of control, very loved, especially by the bartenders at Andy's bar, Bobby Bar, but also inspired not to waste your talent on being drunk. He told me when I was a boy, we have a tradition in Denmark that if you don't smoke when you're 18, your parents will pay for your driver's license. You know, the time you train for a driver's license. So that's like the rule. If you're not smoking, everybody tries to hide that they're smoking. But if you don't smoke officially, your parents will pay for your driver's license. And my father told me when I was a kid, if you don't drink like hell and smoke when you're 18, I will not pay for your driver's license. And I don't smoke and I don't drink a lot. So it's like an opposite, very risky way of bringing up your child. But it worked with me somehow. But of course, I'm also being a control freak due to a very, I don't know the words here, like you don't know what's happening in 5 minutes.
Volatile or unpredictable.
Unpredictable, yeah. So as a child, you are trained from a very early stage to control situations, and TV, not that much radio, but especially TV is like, it's a paradise for a control freak because you need to control things in order to get close to something that is real. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I mean, if you don't prepare, if you're not conscious of the signals you're sending out, people will not experience what you want to tell. That's my theory. And I work together with people that have some of the same characteristics as my father. I seek situations that are difficult to control in order to prove that I'm able to handle it now. Yeah. Which is interesting because then I also have to tell you about my mother because she's the total opposite. She's a person that made me feel extremely safe and gave me so much love that I was able to survive the chaos. And I think that those two very different combinations it's something you, when you become my age, you start realizing how many of your thoughts and actions are programmed from what you experience. And I always hated that when I was younger, you know, especially men my age talking about their father. I was like, I mean, you're a grown up, you know, take control of your own life. Don't sit and talk for hours about your father. It's really boring. But somehow you just start realizing. And what I've done, I think, maybe, I hope, is I've tried to somehow use my traumas in my work. It's the only way I can get something positive out of the things I experienced, you know, trying to change them into something productive somehow.
Can you think of a concrete example of that?
Yeah, starting up a radio channel was something that on paper was like doomed as impossible with that budget and all those very strict guidelines when you're like a public service funded radio channel. And it was just very inspiring for me when someone says something is impossible or very hard to do or not functioning, then it becomes really interesting. I together with my longtime partner, we've worked on and off very close together.
That would be Mads Brügger?
Yeah. We did a TV show where it was like a reading studying group. So Denmark's Radio, which is like the equivalent of the BBC, but in Denmark, which is public service, state-funded TV and radio. And they wanted to do, they were forced to do TV programs about literature, but literature television, in my mind also, had become extremely predictable, you know, talking with an author, how the process of writing has been going on, and they are out there, you know, selling their new book, so they're giving these routine interviews, even though they are extremely lonesome people that are maybe good at writing, but not good at explaining why they write, and filming them walking in a park, kicking dried leaves, you know, while they read something from the book. It's not something that would get people to start reading. It's just extremely boring, bad television. And it also makes television in the cultural hierarchy, suddenly literature is the finest art and television a newer, more looked down upon media that can only be used to communicate the finer art as like a second media. So I remember we were in a meeting in the newly built DR Byen, which was an architectural catastrophe. The building caused many people to be fired because it ran over budget and it was just the atmosphere was on an all-time low. And we were in this meeting room and I remember the editor-in-chief of one of the TV channels said, we want to do a TV show about literature, but no writers or authors are permitted. We don't want to have them involved because they're too boring or they're not good television. And it's quite odd to prohibit authors as participants in a television program about writing or literature. And I remember me and Mads sitting in this empty meeting room, which was those meeting rooms, they don't have a soul. They were very newly built and it's like with a whiteboard and yeah, not very personal. And we were sitting there and just on the other side of Amager Boulevard, there was like a shelter for homeless people. It's a place where everybody can come 24 hours and have a meal and maybe a place to sleep. And I was saying, you know, it's a strange thought that Denmark's Radio is on this side of the road and only 50 meters away, there's a place where homeless people seek shelter. People are going down both sides of the street, but for different reasons. And I said, you know, I wonder how many books are read over there. I mean, if you've lost your home, your family, your work, your mind, is literature something that can provide you anything? I mean, a lot of books is about destiny, people fighting through hard times, and all sorts of gruesome sides of life. But is it something that we use in our luxury life to feel something when we read books? I wonder, is there anyone over there reading books? And Mads said, I mean, we could make a television program where we gather a group of homeless people in a reading group and discuss literature. And we immediately got up and walked over to the shelter, which looks like an old prison. And we asked for the, what do you call that?
The manager or the...
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And met a guy. I thought he was a homeless guy, but he was the man taking charge of the place. But somehow, it's like a Stockholm syndrome. He looked like a homeless man. But we went to his office and told him that we wanted to do a television program with a reading group. And I remember he pointed to a poster in his office and he said, you know, a lot of the people coming here, we have a place where they can paint. Some of them are quite good at painting and it helps them. And I wanted to do an art show with some of their paintings, but you know, it wasn't possible. It's, you cannot contain those wild lives. So I think you should leave the idea of doing those recordings. And I mean, after that meeting, I said, you know, let's just do something else. And Mads said, no, it's when somebody who's working with something says it's impossible, it's interesting. So I said, yeah. And that's something interesting because in what I do, people are extremely obsessed about the finished result. They want to have some kind of safety that the end result will be fine, instead of being very curious about what will happen. You know, don't worry about failing. Don't be obsessed with having success. Be interested in what happens if you do something. Like, it should be the original idea of documentary. But today, you know, if you want to do a documentary film, and you want it financed or funded, you need to explain in details what will happen in this documentary, which is kind of odd, because then being curious is suddenly not interesting anymore, but being safe on the result is the most important thing. So we started trying to collect people who had some kind of experience in their former life of reading. And luckily, there was a girl working there who actually was educated in the fine arts of literature at the university, but she couldn't get any job in working with literature, so she was working there. And we started to work together with her and said, you know, can you talk with people here if somebody has a relationship with reading? And she gathered 4 or 5, and everybody said, you know, they will lose the book, they will sell the book. But somehow, also because of her commitment, we managed for them to read a book. And immediately, actually also, that says something about the importance of details. The photographers we used for those readings were former alcoholics, like AA people, because it's so important, you know. The first time we came to this shelter, the people there threw bricks and bottles after us because we were journalists and they had extremely bad experience. I think a guy named Bubber, a Danish TV host, had been there, and maybe he had filmed people in situations where they were not conscious of what was going on, you know, people overdosing on the stairs with a needle in their arm. So people from television were very unpopular, but choosing photographers who had, you know,
see them at eye level.
You just look them in the eyes and everybody knows, you know, I've been where you are, and that makes a difference. And then we started recording and started reading books, and it's a very long story, this one, but it's, I forgot the question. My problem is when I answer questions in conversations like this, I really try to tell something I haven't told before, but it has the side effect that I'm thinking while I'm talking. So I try to gain time to think of something new to say,
right?
Which makes it extremely long. And people tell me they fall asleep when I'm talking, which is a compliment, I think.
Absolutely.
But every time I go into conversations like this, I just, before I knocked on the door, I said, remember, listen, try to have a regular conversation. And I forget it every time.
Well, it's interesting because you mentioned that your voice puts people to sleep. I read that you said when you were doing Den Elfte Thema, the 11th hour, that you had just one very specific competitor in terms of ratings.
Yeah. It was a late night television show being broadcast at 11 o'clock. And after we had our live broadcastings, reruns were being shown. So it was like, there's a lot of competition in television, but our biggest competitor was people falling asleep, which, yeah. I mean, it sets you free to also broadcast things that people regard as boring.
But this was interesting for me because you had come off the back of 3 very successful years as a commissioner, being behind a string of really successful programs, Jul på Vesterborg, Drengene van Gore, Wolf and Dolph, all of these great programs. And you step out with yourself at the helm as the host. And I just wondered, in that period, were you reacting against what you were seeing at the time in the Danish or international media landscape? Was it you suddenly having access to all the tools you wanted? Because as I read that program, it's borderline absurdist, experimental television. How would you explain it to someone who'd never seen it before?
No, but being an editor-in-chief, my strength going into that job was that I was always very aggressive towards being limited by any bosses at all. My energy was, my boss is an idiot, I want to fight against him. And always typically men somehow. I don't know why, but I only had men as my bosses. And so it became like a very predictable routine that every time I had to come up with new ideas or produce anything, I would react extremely angry at people trying to stop me, which was like a energy that gave me the courage to come up with stuff. But suddenly, when I was asked, well, try to do it better yourself. I mean, if you think that people in charge are idiots, you could get a chance. And that's when you start learning something and not just reacting against something, but try to take responsibility yourself.
Do you think that almost preemptive chip on your shoulder or anarchistic spirit you have, do you think that is tied to being an autodidact?
Like not having any education?
Formal education.
Could be. It's an internal cloud hanging over you that you are not capable. Some call it imposter syndrome. I'm not that insecure, but you have to prove that you are able to solve this project or this task you have been given, and then combine it with public service, which is, you know, you really have to take advantage of the possibilities and not just copy the commercial world. So those things combined really starts something, and it's really blood, sweat, and tears. You really go into it with a lot of self-confidence combined with humbleness, and it's interesting what that starts in me. And being offered the opportunity to be in charge, have a budget, you know, search for new talent, give them the same chance as I had gotten earlier, was a very interesting opportunity. And I had to learn that choosing people that were very different from me was the best, instead of trying to hire somebody that I thought could do something similar to what I could do myself, which is totally unproductive and a very bad way of inspiring other people to, you know, come with the attitude that, I mean, I could do this, but now I have this job, so I'm letting you do it instead. But so I started just hiring people who liked to discuss with me, who wanted to do the total opposite of what I wanted to do. It's a really good idea to go after those people. And that culminated with Radio 24/7, where everybody was just totally out of control. So I had this job for 3 years, and my advantages compared with the other executives was that I had the experience of sitting there, knowing what it takes to really jump off the cliff. But after 3 years, it had become like hollow talk somehow, because I had become like a middle management guy. And it was very tiring to hear me still standing on the experiences I've had as a host. So it came to a time where being so routine experienced, it was a reaction, because everything at that time was very obsessed with having a format, like a concept. You know, you develop a concept and then you sing the same song night after night, day after day. It's the same song you're singing because the format is so strict and so perfectly designed that you are boxed into those rules that the format dictates. And I said, let's do a late night talk show where every night we need to think of it as a new format. So there is no concept. So Monday night, it could be like a quiz show. Tuesday night, it could be a very like serious artist talk. And then Wednesday night, it could be like a crime show. And then I had another idea, which was all the guests has to be somebody who has created something. I mean, television was at that point, maybe still is, people commenting on what somebody else has been creating. Also, people commenting on political thoughts from politicians, you know, just digesting, trying to talk about how do they spin this. It's, but nobody has said, you know, I've created this and it would not exist if I didn't put this work into the world. So there was like a rule hidden underneath that it didn't matter if you wrote a book of poetry that 50 people had bought, or you've done a extremely successful movie, or, I mean, just saluting people creating something, which were very seldom to see.
Yeah. And that mantra absolutely comes through in terms of the way that you would host the program and interact with your guests.
So you were living in Denmark at that time. So you've been here for many years.
Many years.
How long time?
15 years.
15 years.
Yeah. I actually learned Danish by watching Tangerine van Gore.
Oh, yeah.
That was kind of what we were passing around on DVD at language school.
But 15 years in Denmark?
Yeah.
15 winters?
Yeah.
Coming from Australia? How do you survive the Danish winter?
I think the first few were a novelty, so I was able to get through them quite easily. But then probably when it came to about the third, fourth, fifth year, I realized that I have to go back around Christmas and break it up.
So you go back?
Yeah.
It's a long flight.
It is a long flight.
So you go back during wintertime?
I do. I go back for usually 3 to 4 weeks, and that just breaks the back of it.
It must do. Because I have kids. I have 3 kids. Now they're grown up, the youngest being 18. But she's still in school, and therefore you are like locked in a system. But I mean, this winter,
it's been tough.
It's been really tough. Very dark. It's like it's been raining for 5 months, 6 months, every day.
Yeah.
When you come to Copenhagen Airport, you can be up there, the sun is shining above the skies, and then you land and you go through 3-4 layers of a carpet of gray skies, which means light is totally locked out. It's not coming through.
You're really selling it.
Yeah, yeah, but I'm curious because if you are like coming from a country where, I mean, why be here?
I get that question a lot, but yeah, I think
it's not a very original question.
No.
But it's I don't understand.
Well, I think there's plenty of good reasons to live here, but I'm particularly interested in different cultures and the fact that it's not just about living in Denmark, but having access to all these interesting places in Europe. I think that's something that many people here take for granted.
Yeah. But doing these interviews, is that also to get to know?
Well,
it's called Nordic Portraits. Is it to get to know this place or what? Well,
no, I would say it's one step beyond that. So I think I've gotten to scratch under the surface, but for me, it's now more about sharing the stories that I find really compelling with the rest of the world, trusting that they find them as interesting as I do. And it seems to this point that they do, which is great.
Okay.
So there seems to be an appetite for people to hear more about artists and their stories and what's happening here.
But what is happening here? I can't see it.
Well,
nothing's happening. I mean,
you might feel that way, but if I was to take your body of work, for example, the program we're talking about, The 11th Hour, what you were doing there, I think, is quite incredible and quite brilliant. And of course, I get it. It was broadcast on Danish television, so it would largely have gone unnoticed internationally. But for me, personally, having discovered this chapter of Danish television that you were largely the mastermind behind, the fact that, for example, you would have David Lynch on as a guest, and instead of asking him the stock standard questions about his films, you have a second guest demonstrating transcendental meditation whilst you're offering Lynch a coffee made by an award-winning barista and then pestering him to describe the coffee and how good it is. I wouldn't want that to just pass us by without it being preserved or celebrated.
No.
And that actually leads me to a question regarding you as host and your role in front of camera.
Of course, Mads Brügger, which I developed the show with, also had an extremely important impact. Our conversations, we are very different, but when we decide on something and we argue and we find a common ground, it has a strong, because it's, of course, really important. And there was a Danish author called Yannick Storm. He was translating Philip K. Dick novels, which Mads was and is a huge fan of science fiction and Philip K. Dick. And the girl in Blade Runner, Mads heard from somebody that it was a Danish girl who inspired Philip K. Dick to that character. And he visited this translator, Yannick Storm, in an elderly home in the southern part of Denmark. And suddenly Mads wanted to find this girl because the translator had a picture of her. And supposedly Philip K. Dick fell in love with her. And so he got this photo, but he also wanted to invite this translator, author, Yannick Storm, into the studio. But he was like 86 years old and he was forgotten in this elderly home. And I was at home and Mads called me just minutes before they went on air and said, you know, Yannick Storm has just been transported in a wheelchair into the television studio and we need to carry him to his chair. Actually, because it was one of my few nights off, I wanted to go to sleep, but I had to see, you know, how will he survive this interview? It was an extremely vulnerable conversation, extremely slow, because he was weak and old. But the courage to do a live conversation with a man who still had interesting thoughts, but on a level that was not suitable for modern television was extremely, I've never seen anything like it.
Mm.
I was really impressed by the courage. More difficult than going to North Korea to do a documentary, I would say.
Wow.
And it didn't happen every night, but we challenged each other to go places when nobody else had the thought of going or the courage to go. And so in that sense, it also becomes a competition between two people who challenge each other on how can we try to use this opportunity.
But when you're hosting something like that, are you playing a character? Is it a heightened version of yourself?
No, it's I get that question a lot, and it has become something that I've been confronted with for almost 30 years now, and something which are really difficult for foreigners to understand.
Yeah.
Because then you come into the, not the Nordic, but the Danish soul of sarcasm, irony, which falsely is being dated back to the 90s, where you had these postmodern media guys who said everything has been tried, everything has been thought of, so now we make like a smoothie of distant ironic jokes. We will bring a popular 70s pop star into the television studio, now he's drunk, and we will make fun of him, which is like not a very nice thing to do. And you don't have anything to tell. You're just like picking up stuff and you're holding them very far from yourself and just laughing at it. But for me, I think it goes back to something else. It's my mother's side of the family, a Jewish Copenhagen family, many of them brought to concentration camps, many of them haunted by anxiety, suicide after the war, but still, you know, sitting as a child together with my mother, my grandmother, my mother's sister, everything, you know, the pain was being dealt with in an extremely sarcastic tone. And you can also date it back to, I mean, the Greeks, Socrates, Søren Kierkegaard, irony as a weapon, which is extremely dangerous. But for me, being extremely shy and limited in my ability to perform on radio, later television, I can only explain it by not promising the viewers that I'm able to be myself. You know, for me, it's a very honest way of communicating that I have limits to how relaxed I can be, how far I can go. If you see like a feel-good family entertainment show, they just switch on a button that says, now we're having a good time. But maybe you're not having a good time. Maybe you are in a totally different mood that night. So be honest about that, or do not go further into that cozy hygge feeling that you think people want. And late at night, especially den 11. time, if it's the last thing you see before you fall asleep, why not plant other thoughts in people's minds? But concerning me, it has something to do with, it's really difficult to explain, but I will try explain, because I just said, you know, I will not defend myself concerning irony. It's never been a goal for me to be ironic. I hate when people are ironic, which is ironic. I mean, it's really something I don't like. And because of that, it's strange that I happen to broadcast on that frequency. But I can only say that it has to do with being really aware of what I'm capable of. Combine that with when I started doing television, there were all these rules where you're just, as a host, put into a system where somebody says, you need to have cue cards. You need to look in the camera being confident. We want you to read from this teleprompter. It's a lot of tools that you are being equipped with because everybody is insecure. Everybody is afraid that if we don't use these safety tools, this guy will fall through. You can't have a news anchor that doesn't know what's up next. You can't have this guy sitting there thinking for 10 seconds, 5 seconds, 2 seconds of thought from a host will make people insecure. And starting in television, I was forced into these routines and just felt that they were very bad for me. They were limiting me from trying to come close to being myself, which is now it becomes very complicated because and then, I mean, being nervous, insecure, very humble about the opportunity I get, combine that with a self-confidence that makes me able to say, I don't want a teleprompter. I don't want anybody to control my way of talking, my tempo, my way of sitting there. I would rather just sit there falling through. And if I don't know what I will be asking my guests in a second, I don't mind sitting there thinking of the next question. That creates maybe some of the noise about how I present myself, but it comes from an intention of trying to learn to actually be close to who I am, which is extremely difficult. You know, I when I sit here talking with you, I also start speed talking. And where does that come from? Maybe nervousness? I don't know. We could try say nothing, see what happens. Maybe that would be good for me and for the people listening. But I can only say that showing up here, I've never met you. I knock on a stranger's door. I'm in a building where I've been walking this street many times. I've never been in here. My father is buried. Just I can see his grave from here. You have a beautiful view over one of the biggest cemeteries in Copenhagen. But the situation, you know, pretending that we know each other, that's a lie. And everybody is pretending. You know, we are having a good time. And I have a show. I need to have somebody in here who can fill out my time slot. You have a new book out. You want to sell your new book. Let's make that deal that everybody gets something out of the situation. But, I mean, why not be more honest about that deal, that you're actually stealing time from the people watching because you just, it's extremely lazy. Nobody has thought anything. It's just, let's play the game of us having a nice conversation. That is, for me, irony. A news anchor host who pretends to know how the world is put together, what's going on in the world, that's a lie. He doesn't know. He reads from a teleprompter. His eyes are dead. He's a perfect machine. But when he gets up, gets out of the TV studio, go home to his wife, maybe they are in the middle of a divorce, he doesn't talk like that. He's not so secure and confident. He's asking a question. Nobody answers. That's closer to a real human being. So I would love to be able to switch on a certain kind of atmosphere. Then you're really a professional. Unfortunately, I'm not a professional. I need to still try to develop those skills. And now I do conversations with people that I record. And the recordings are being archived in the Royal National Library. And then they are, it's marathon interviews. I mean, it's 4 or 5 hours of conversations, and the conversations are being archived, and then they are being edited and broadcast when the interview person has died. That's, it sounds morbid, but it isn't. It's just the television version of naming a street after somebody.
But a street can't provide an outlet for someone to have the final word.
No, I was since I was a very little boy, I've been collecting autographs from football stars, rock stars, actors. I've been obsessed.
Who's the most famous person you've received an autograph from?
Pelé.
Wow.
Or Brigitte Bardot. I started out collecting autographs from football stars. And it starts with the World Championships in 1978. Argentina wins, and Sevilla, I think, or Valencia comes to Copenhagen for like a match against the Danish team. And I get Mario Kempes, Ardiles. Italy is playing in Copenhagen. I get Dino Sof, Paolo Rossi. You're too young for those, but they were one of the biggest generations of football players. And I stand outside these football stadiums waiting for them to come out. And it's, I don't know why that's something, but it's, I've spent a second together with Pelé in his life.
See, that's the interesting thing for me, because it can be seen two ways. Are you collector by nature, and is that the interest for you to have captured something, or is it the interaction, the fact that you know that you've spent that moment in time with someone? Is that what you're truly wanting to collect from the experience?
I don't know.
Has it subsided over time?
Yeah, it has, but my autograph collection, I have 100 football players. Then suddenly I'm in Paris with my father. He was drawing some of the early cafes in Copenhagen, Café Victor.
Yes, that's right.
And he was in Paris to find inspiration, because all the pubs in Denmark were like really dark, brown, smoky places. And him and some of his partners wanted to start this whole Southern European feeling of a cafe, which they tried to import to Denmark. And because of that, he had to do some really heavy research drinking in Paris. And I was with him on one of those travels, and we are in a restaurant, and suddenly Brigitte Bardot is sitting on a table not far from us. And I saw the movie.
Contempt? Was it Jean-Luc Godard?
Yeah. Or? Yeah?
Yeah.
I've seen that movie. And then I get her autograph, and then I come home and I get the autograph of a Danish comedian called Eddie Skoller. Kind of a very early, like one man on a stage telling jokes, pre-stand-up comedy. But so the autograph book is a lot of football players. No, a lot of football players, then Eddie Skoller, the comedian, then Brigitte Bardot. And then after that, empty pages. So it's like, I play a lot of football. I discover humor. And then I see Pushitparu. And then I stop. Then my mind is onto something else.
And how, in your mind, does that relate to your program, The Last Word?
No, I guess it's being in the company of someone. There's a connection somehow. Whether in the company of Pele for a second or being in the company with somebody else for an hour.
Nordic Portraits is a series by me, Ben Catford. The music was composed by Nina Liu and the visual identity by Copenhagen-based studio Frame. To learn more about today's guest and all the others from this season, visit nordicportraits.net. You can also follow us on Instagram and remember to rate and subscribe on iTunes so we can get the word out. Thanks for listening.